To quote a famous stoner from Jersey, we won't spank the monkey will spank us. Welcome back to For the Love of a Franchise. I am your host, P-Dubs, and joining me for our first look at the Planet of the Apes series is Tony.
I love you, Dr. Zaius.
I thought you might use that one.
Obvious, wasn't it, really? Free hitter.
Yeah. So for anybody that doesn't know, the quote at the start was from Jay and Silent Bob, where there's an homage to this film. And I have a poster from Jay and Silent Bob with that exact quote on it from Jason Mewes. So I had to use that. Just thought it was appropriate. So yep, we are here to kick off our look at the Planet of the Apes franchise, the original Planet of the Apes franchise. We're recording this on the day that the trailer for the newest one is due to join us this evening. For the Super Bowl. So quite appropriate that we're recording this tonight. This was my choice.
Anniversary of its release was this week as well, I think, the first film.
Yeah, that would make sense. Obviously, this is my latest choice, as we alluded to on the last show. Now there is only two of us. It's going to be a quick change every half a year or so. There'll be a new one. Let's kick off. So this is the first Planet of the Apes, the original Charlton Heston starring Planet of the Apes. So we don't normally do facts and figures on this because there's too many for when you're looking at a franchise like this. So let's just jump straight in. Did say that the quite typical 1960s science fiction spaceship and special effects. very much so. There's definitely no doubt into that. And it does kick off kind of in a bit of a strange way, in a non kind of science fiction film way, but in a science fiction book way.
Yeah, it's very mellow. It sort of opens in the ship, doesn't it? And it's quite a low key start, actually.
Yeah, and a very long speech from Heston as well, right at the beginning, which is very much a book thing to have the lead character kind of lead you in with a massive, great big speech. And obviously, this is book based on a book. Yes. For anybody that doesn't know, so it's very much taken from that.
And it's a good way of doing the info dump as well. It's just done in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
This is how they come to be in space, et cetera, et cetera. And it's done and it's out of the way then.
Yeah, definitely. And I was going to say, did they age Heston up in this? Because he even looks old in this.
I don't think so particularly. We did him on one of our other podcasts, of course, when you in The Greatest Show on Earth, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And he always had an old looking face anyway, I think. That was the trouble.
Yeah, it's just strange when you consider he was still working kind of up to the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Just amazing when you think he made a cameo in Friends. Very, very late in Friends as well. It wasn't even an early cameo. Amazing career. clearly, because he really does look like that. I wanted to bring something up, kind of a crossover with one of our other podcasts, that the kind of the whole thing of them crashing on the planet. Very reminiscent of what they did on WandaVision. Even now, using the same type of techniques. The last shot when they pan to her in the cabin. Kind of the shot of them crashing and coming onto the planet, which, spoiler, is Earth. reminiscent of that final shot from WandaVision.
Yeah. And I did sort of know that it's very cleverly done in terms of the ways of limited budget, of just those fast cuts of exterior shots and stuff, to effectively simulate the crashing, isn't it?
It's very, very clever. Yeah, it is, as I say. For something like WandaVision that's got all of that technology now and the use of a drone, for that shot as well.
Yeah.
To consider that you can kind of compare those shots is amazing when you think it's 60 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
To do the same kind of technique is unbelievable.
I guess it would have been helicopter shot back then as well. So it would have been,
yeah,
slap the camera on the side of an helicopter to do those sort of fast zoom ins and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. Then obviously we get the shock of it all having gone wrong. Opening things up. That the decomposing bodies are really quite grisly.
Yeah, the other fourth member, I can't remember, Stuart, isn't it? Yeah, Stuart, yeah. Is it? It's a real shock, actually. They sort of cut back and see what happened to her. I guess that the air got in somewhere.
Yeah, and then the shock of the water rushing in,
yeah,
as well. You don't expect that at all. You think, oh, they've landed on a planet. Everything's fine, and then all of a sudden the water comes pouring in. And I did want to note, with the way they'd... they put makeup on them, they looked like apes before they even began. How hairy they were.
They've got there's a little bit of sideburns action going on, isn't there? And
yeah. Yeah, definitely. And then we kind of get, it doesn't even feel kind of really like a sci-fi film, though I suppose you can compare it to current day with Dune. In the way that it's kind of composed, with the desert stuff and really desolate, but it doesn't feel like a sci-fi film at that point. They kind of leave the spaceship behind and they're kind of on their own, and it feels like it could be anything.
Yeah.
At that point, if you caught that bit, you wouldn't know what it was.
Yeah, to them crossing all that desert countryside is almost a Western vibe to it. That sort of,
yeah. Yeah, very much so.
And they're very bleak as well. Beautifully shot, though. It's really bleak and imposing, that sort of desert.
Yeah, and practical filming.
Yeah.
Definitely, it does make a difference. I don't care what people say. As great as films look these days, you can't beat a practical bit of filming.
And location shooting as well.
Yeah.
It's always...
Yeah.
I know the big thing now is to use that... A lot of the back green screen stuff is on that special room, isn't it, they use now?
Yeah.
I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head.
The thing that Disney used for the... We've talked about it a multitude on other podcasts. Yeah. It just hasn't been brought up. The volume. There you go. It's just came into my head, the volume. But yeah.
It's very good, but you're still kind of aware that they've used it.
Yeah, and do you know what? I sat down to watch... It's the anniversary this year, but it wasn't that. I had a mental week at work, and it came to Friday night, and I just wanted something easy to watch. And I turned on The Phantom Menace. I thought, I'll go through the Star Wars stuff again, because I haven't done it for a couple of years. I thought, I'll start doing that again. And even that, it's so obvious how little of it is practical. It's just when you compare it to the new ones, the Disney films, that, as we've just talked about, the volume, there's a noticeable difference.
Yeah.
Because at least the volume is using real locations as such.
Yeah, I mean, modern filmmaking now with things like the volume, I mean, they don't even really have furniture and stuff now in these things when they shoot on that stuff.
No.
It's all just coloured blocks when they fill it in, don't they?
Yeah, at least with the volume, they have gone and filmed something.
Yeah.
And then put it kind of in the background. It's not all computer generated. It's just that they've projected it onto something else.
Yeah. But I mean, like you say, with this, there's buttons in the cockpit and there's things that flip up and shut down and clamber out of.
You can liken it to, it's a bigger budget Doctor Who, isn't it? Because Doctor Who at that point was very much the same. It was brand new and it was filmed in the same kind of way. But obviously, despite this being a lower budget for a movie, it was very much that type of time.
And similarly, when they get to we'll get there, Ape Central, it's very tangible and real in there. But it's the bit in between that is quite shocking. Though when you first see the local people
Yeah.
And they're all mute, and I think.
Yeah.
First time I watched the film years and years ago, I didn't really know what was going on at the start like that at all. Okay.
No, see, it's weird because it's a set of films that kind of grew up in, I grew up with, but never kind of diving into as such. Mm. I was quite young. My brother loved these films.
Yeah.
Weirdly, because he's a massive animal fan. He'd go to zoos and stuff like that. So it was kind of that sort of reasoning behind why he liked them. But also he's a science fiction fan. So it makes sense.
Yeah, I got that very much off my uncle of mine. And as I think I said on a podcast in the past, I mean, I watched just sitting down in an afternoon and evening as a kid growing up with my parents, just watching films on telly. And of course, yep. At that point in the sort of 70s and 80s, they were films that were 10, 15, 20 years old anyway. So
yeah. Yeah. And it's weird because I came around kind of when the Planet of the Apes TV series was going. And that's kind of my memory of it more than the films is probably.
Yeah.
And that was my introduction to a lot of films. Like I remember watching the RoboCop TV series.
Ah.
And stuff like that. And that kind of led me to film because I'd go in, my brother's, I don't know, I probably mentioned it, my brother's 20 years older than me. So he was watching things like, and how we met. I yeah. walked in on him watching the last episode of Buffy season 3 as Angel walked away.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd never seen Buffy at that point. I was what? 16, 15, yeah. 16 at that point, and kind of just finding myself. And I walked in and watched, saw the end of that, and I thought, oh, that looks quite good. And then a couple of weeks later, we went, oh, they're doing a spin-off of that now. and I ended up watching Angel, and that's kind of how I got into what I love now. So my brother is kind of that entrance. But yeah, likewise, Planet of the Apes was one of those films that I saw probably bits and pieces of all the time. So,
yeah.
But the next thing, as you mentioned, and we both just talked about, it doesn't feel like a science fiction film for a large portion of the opening of it. It kind of feels more like a thriller.
And also,
you're wondering what's going to happen.
Expedition films, basically. They find the lost tribe, et cetera, et cetera. And the obligatory new swimming scene and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very strange opening. If you didn't know what it was... Look, you take the title away and no one would have a clue.
Yeah, yeah.
I did want to mention that weird that the only bit of life they find to start with is that plant and they dig it up and kill it.
Yes, I did. I did jot that down as well, actually.
It's like the only bit of life you have found on the entire planet up until this point. And you go, right, I'm going to dig that up and take it with me.
I did note that myself.
Yeah. I suppose at this point, as you mentioned, we get the local people. Caveman. We've dissolved into cavemen.
Mm.
Again, we've reverted. But once we meet the apes... That makeup, I think that has pretty much influenced every bit of film makeup since.
Yes. Yeah, and it's incredible for 1968, 69, the release them do that. Particularly with the chimpanzees, it's perfect chimpanzee face.
Yeah, and the fact that it moves, and let's put it this way, I can only guess that a lot of the work was done in post when it comes to what they were saying.
Well, yeah, there must have been some ADR on it, I guess. Quite a bit of ADR, I guess. The looping is, people might not be aware, that's what they do.
Because I would imagine on set they could probably understand what they were saying, but I can't imagine that the microphones were picking up what they were saying.
Yeah, you can imagine it wouldn't have been that clear. I mean, we know from going back to things like Buffy and Angel and all the other science fiction stuff we've watched, that it's one thing that's come out of convention stuff. The actors have said sometimes that things like vampire teeth and stuff like that were a struggle to sort of speak through.
Yeah, let alone a full face of makeup.
Yeah.
So, God knows what it was made of back then as well. Yeah. And then it really does take a dark turn, doesn't it?
We start with the hunting sequence.
Yeah.
And the film kind of never lets up from there once you get that reveal that there are apes on this planet that are hunting humans.
Yeah. Really, and it proper becomes dystopian, doesn't it, at that point?
Yeah. But this also the start of some really dark and sort of clever throwaway gags as well. One of the apes sort of comments on human see, human do, which of course the original phrase is monkey see.
Yeah, and we get an early version of the catchphrase that became so famous from it. We get "Damn you, dirty humans."
Yeah,
not "Damn you, dirty apes," which comes later in the film. The first mutter of it is "Damn you, dirty humans."
Yeah, that's right. And then that hunting raid as well. They're like they got like an old school camera and they're taking a photograph.
Yeah,
I thought it was a really clever one as well.
Yeah.
Just this complete reversal of things, yeah.
Yeah, really. And that was my next note. It is a real study of evolution.
Yeah.
Of where it could go or could have gone.
Yeah. And of course, that's as the film plays out. That's one of the themes, is sort of history and evolution, and the film turns it on its head, of course.
Yeah.
With Dr. Zaius being a sort of a denier, and that's like a film in the 68, which you sort of mirror in deniers of stuff now.
Yeah.
Years ahead of its time in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I suppose I, at this point, I do have to mention the monkey snogging. Very strange. Very, very strange.
Not as strange as the one again.
No, definitely not. But the relationship is astonishing, but between all of the humans and the different types of apes as well.
You can see the agendas, like the orangutans are this very sort of pompous, stubborn sort of.
And how did that happen? How did the orangutans become the king of monkeys?
Yeah,
because they're very much not.
Gorillas, you tend to think of, don't you?
So. Yeah. And they're kind of the grunt work, the gorillas.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's what's so clever about it is that I suppose if you study, I never really studied them, but maybe orangutans are that more studious sort of element of apes.
Yeah, possibly.
That kind of fits in well.
Yeah, definitely. It's very interesting. And the apes are so scared of a man, but want to deny that he's evolved. It's so strange that they kind of don't want to believe that he is what he is.
Yeah, yeah, and well, this is it. And and of course, effective kind of propaganda is another element of the film. And that indoctrination that humans were a lower form of life and that they can't speak and et cetera. Which is why that when Taylor does speak for the first time, it's such a great moment. This the shock on all the apes' faces.
Yeah.
And then of course the denial kicks in again. And, it's a trick. And
unbelievable. And it's really intriguing to see kind of that first relationship that he has with the human girl.
Where
it seems like there's a real connection, and obviously. She's slightly more evolved than some of the others and things like that, but it's kind of like there's a disconnect, obviously, because she can't communicate with him in a way that he can. And obviously that then moves on to him kind of having that relationship with an ape that's as highly intelligent as he is. A very real juxtaposition between the two relationships.
Yeah, so it is relationship with Cornelius.
Yeah.
And I can't remember, I always forget her name, the other Cornelius' partner, the doctor.
Yeah.
But his relationship with those two is great. And also with the Initially with the sort of cell keeper as well. He's got an interesting sort of dynamic with him.
Yeah. Very much so. It's really interesting to see how he kind of connects with all these different, they are apes, but these different kind of races, because they are. There's different races amongst them, obviously.
Yeah, they've got like the caste system almost, haven't they, with the three types of apes?
Yeah, so. Yeah, definitely. And I'm sure as we go further on into these films, that we'll learn more about that culture and how it's been built up. I did have one question. Why is there no baboons?
Yes, that's true, actually, yeah.
Baboons tend to be the type of ape that people go to, don't they? Obviously, we've got Kong. He's not but you're thinking of things like Lion King and stuff like that. Baboons always seem to be kind of the pain in the arse, don't they? Into the blue arse, should I say.
Yeah, so the fact that the film just effectively sort of distills it down to the three main ones, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The chimps and the gorillas. I suppose probably just for convenience so much as anything.
Yeah, I suspect definitely.
The boom mask would have been quite a tricky one to make.
Yeah, I would imagine so. And talking of backsides, we do get a view of Charlton Heston's backside late on in this film, which we didn't know and didn't need to see.
You're talking about the culture in a minute ago, just a second ago, I think. It was interesting we see when Taylor makes that first break and escape and he sort of stumbles through a funeral. Because the first time I saw that, I didn't quite think straight away what it was.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very, very interesting into what traits they've taken from the humans.
Yeah.
Very, very strange. I did say that the lead ape does remind me of Derek Jacobi a little bit. I don't know why. He just does. I wanted to point that out. We do obviously get that line kind of towards the back end, damn you dirty apes, which has obviously become the line that kind of everybody knows. And it's throughout culture. Talking of things like Friends, I think it was used in that.
The other one that came out of the film, it's a madhouse.
Yeah.
It's another one you can use in places as well.
Yeah, but loads of stuff. That was used in Buffy, to lead back to that. And Xander uses that.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's amazing how a film like this that was kind of like a cult classic kind of then became something different. I would say probably in the 90s when the remake came along, the Tim Burton version, it became a little bit something more. I think because it wasn't the greatest received film, I think a lot of people went back and watched the originals.
Yeah.
At that point, and it became something greater, and it really did permeate culture, pop culture at that point.
I was just going to say, in this sort of middle segment of the film, there's a couple of really dark moments, of course, when we see the fate of his two colleagues.
Yeah, the lobotomy.
Yeah, one's been lobotomized and the other's been stuffed.
Yeah.
The museum, that's just so creepy when he comes across him in the museum.
Yeah, very, very weird. That's when it gets into its proper science fiction roots, doesn't it?
The Ape City stuff, it's so creepy sometimes.
Yeah.
And then we see the lobotomy of his other mate. And Zayas knew exactly what he was doing. And we find out at the end, he knew all along what the situation was. And he kind of knew that they were from Earth's past.
And
he's just such a cunt, basically.
Yeah,
he's a proper old school villain, Zayas, in this film.
And very much I wanted to say that Charlton Heston puts in a really powerful performance, but that performance as well is superb.
Yeah,
considering it's through makeup,
and sometimes the best, and we've seen it in other stuff with you guys, sometimes the best villains are the officious, the suit wearing ones, and he's exactly one of those.
Yeah, very much so. And then we kind of get to that end portion. I think the portion that kind of everybody knows with the reveal and everything at the end, that beach has kind of become synonymous with the film, hasn't it?
The film is quite clever, really, having back and watched it, because it leads you towards that ending from the minute they go into the cave.
Yeah.
And you think, well, that's the doll on another planet that goes like, Mama.
Yeah.
And what's going on here then?
it's a very clever reveal in that, that final portion of the film, that it slowly becomes aware that, oh God, this is where I'm from.
Yeah.
This is what's happened.
But for him and the audience, it doesn't really kick in until we get that final shot.
No, and that kind of confirms it, doesn't it? You kind of have a feeling something's coming.
Yeah.
But that final shot is ridiculous.
And cleverly done, because of course it's done in two parts, because we see the torch first.
Yeah.
What the hell's that then? It's a weird sticky out thing.
Yeah.
And then of course we get the sort of the second cut back to it with the camera. And I wonder how many people at the time sort of twigged from the minute the camera starts to pan.
Yeah.
And you see the separate spikes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really clever shot.
Yeah.
And obviously my quote at the start, that's the scene in Jay and Silent Bob, is that he is on the beach and the Statue of Liberty is in front of him.
Yeah.
And obviously the storyline in Jay and Silent Bob is that there's an orangutan that's leading everybody a merry dance. And they use that exact shot of the Statue of Liberty, because obviously they're from New Jersey, which is next to New York. It kind of works. So again, there it is, permeating popular culture.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the infamous, and then one of the famous ones, of course, is that Mel Brooks pinched it for Spaceballs.
Yeah.
And it's really brilliantly done. Sort of the meter maid or whatever it was to the spaceship sort of end up in the sand on the planet.
Yeah. And it does kind of revert back to being having that Western feel, doesn't it, at the end? There's a horse riding and stuff like that.
Yeah,
it does.
Sort of riding off into the sun.
Yeah, it harkens back to what we said at the start of the film, that it kind of had that Western feel.
Yeah. And we have, of course, Zaius is sort of, we said that Zaius kind of knew what was going on. And he practically gives him a hint right on as he leaves, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He said, telling him you may not like what he finds. And he knew what he was going to find.
Yeah.
Because he'd probably been there itself at some point. As I say, he'd always known all along. And the warning is right there front and center for him.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a really well put together ending to the film. And does. Even if at the time I've got no idea whether they plan to do other films after this, but it really does set up an ongoing story as well. What has happened to where I was from that's caused this? That's really my thoughts. Was there anything else you wanted to dive into, Tony, before we give our final thoughts?
Just a couple of quick things. There's another gag I wanted to mention as well, which is so clever when they're doing the inquiry with the three monkeys, one with his face covered and one with his eyes and one with the ears.
Yeah.
And I think it's just a great gag, visual gag, just the three wise monkeys.
Yeah.
And it's such a left field gag for quite a clever film, but it works perfectly. It's so cleverly done. Hear no, see no, and speak no.
Yeah.
And the other thing that really stands out for me is a lot of the film in that wrap-up is basically all about faith versus science.
Yeah.
And again, it's quite a deep sort of thing for 1968 to be doing. But it, like the best stuff, it's all done as metaphor and allegory, and it's so cleverly done.
Yeah. I think that's what you take from this film, isn't it? When you really dive into it, how clever it is. But for a science fiction, and I think science fiction does it better than probably a lot of genres, is that they sell it in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think about modern science fiction, The Terminator?
Yeah.
It is another prime example
of this
exact type of film. RoboCop, even, as we mentioned earlier, is another one.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, Terminator is all about sort of predestination and destiny. And RoboCop is effectively about what it means to be a human.
Yeah.
What is humanity?
Yeah, and science fiction does it just has a different knack to telling those stories. It's not so overt that it's right in your face. You kind of have to dive into those films to kind of get what they're talking about.
And I don't want to get too much into sort of culture wars and stuff. And I think that that's one of the accusations that's thrown a lot of modern TV and shows now, is that it's not subtle enough.
Yeah,
it sort of just bangs you on the head with the themes and stuff. And I think it's a fair comment. There is stuff, and then that kind of then plays into the anti-woke brigade, etc. Because it's kind of, oh look, this is a film about, yeah, you're supposed to let the audience work that out, but yeah, they almost don't want to wait for the audience to work it out.
Yeah, it's like they have to make it obvious for those people that so desperately want to talk about it that it's front and center, and they'll go, oh, look at that. We can watch this, and it's there for everybody to see. And as an audience, we go to see a film, hopefully not knowing that much about it, and wanting to take from the film rather than going into it and expecting.
Yeah, you want to come out and think, okay, interesting.
Yeah. Do you want, if you're going to see a film like that, you want it to work your brain.
Even
if you're going to a superhero film, or in this case, a science fiction film, you don't want it to be easy on you. You don't want it to tax you.
No,
you also want to work for it.
Yeah, you don't want to be bashed over the head with an encyclopedia or in a science book, but you also don't want it done as a join the dots for you necessarily on screen.
Yeah, and I think that kind of takes us into our final thoughts, because this for me is an unbelievable film in that sense. Yeah. For a film that, as we've just said, is 60 years old now, nearly. Just amazing what they did, both with what we saw on screen and what came from the scripts. I didn't know what to expect, because, as I said, I kind of remember the TV series. I'll be honest, I've never seen the remake. Didn't interest me, because, honestly, it didn't look any better.
The Burton film was that one.
Yeah. Whereas the new ones are very different. But they weren't a remake, were they? They were completely a completely new thing, whereas the Burton one was a remake of the original film. No. And you look at it, I love Tim Burton. Look, I'm a Batman 89 guy.
Yeah.
As much as I love Nolan's Batman, nothing will beat those first two Batman movies that Burton did. But in terms, he's lost his way at times. Not everything he's done has been great.
Yeah, and this was one of the first ones. And you watch it, and it doesn't feel like a Burton film. There is no element in the film, really, that feels like it's Tim Burton. It feels like a by-the-numbers studio picture.
Yeah. So that for me, sitting down and watching this original film, was kind of a new experience as an adult, I would say. And for me, the score is up there at around 88. I absolutely thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, so just a little bit lower than mine, because I'm a big fan of this film, always have been. It's one of my top 10, probably possibly one of my top 5 science fiction films of all time. To me, it doesn't really hit a bum note. Some great performances, like I said, great makeup, beautifully shot, sets, fantastic for a film from that. And score-wise, I'm going to go probably the highest I've ever given anything. You don't really want to go to 100, but I'm going to give this a 95. It's one of my favourite films.
I honestly don't blame you. They're not going to be films that I'm ever going to pick for this podcast, because they're just too obvious. One we've already mentioned in the Terminator series. It's just too obvious for me, and likewise Back to the Future. So there are a couple of science fiction set of films that I would put above this. So that's why I kind of can't go much higher with my score, just because there's films in the same genre that I would put above. But then again, too obvious for me to pick to talk about on this show, which I'd be left field.
the two you mentioned, the Terminator and the Back to the Future, the first one, I probably put back 94, 95 as well.
Yeah.
And the three of them, they're all pretty much perfect science fiction films for me.
Yeah, very much so. So there we have it. First Planet of the Apes in the bag. Thank you, Tony. I don't really need to thank you, do I? Because it's one of your favourite films. You probably would have watched it again if I hadn't put it in front of you.
Anyway, so, yeah.
But thank you for joining me tonight as we're recording this. Looking forward to carrying on talking about these films.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see your reactions. Have you seen any of the sequels at all?
Probably not. Not that I can remember. So
let's just say we've had this with the franchise. There's a wild variety in quality.
yeah, and that's what this is all about, I think.
All about, absolutely.
I don't think we've picked a franchise so far that we can go, do you know what? All of those films are great.
Or all of them are stinkers, yeah.
We've picked ones that vary in quality so we can see those differences. So I knew there would be some quality control issues across this franchise, and that was kind of, I'd had it in my head kind of for nearly a year since my last slot that this would be my next choice. So I'm looking forward to diving into the sequels. So thank you very much, listeners, for joining us. We will see you next month for our thoughts on the second Planet of the Apes movie. We'll see you somewhere down the road.